Welcome to another founder-to-founder interview from Gun.io, your source for hiring world-class tech talent. Today, Gun.io's CEO and co-founder, Teja Yanamandra, sits down with Matt Genovese, founder and CEO of Planorama, a professional services company that designs intuitive products and helps accelerate your software development process. Okay, here's Teja.
My parents immigrated to Jackson Heights in New York City. And so I grew up like part of my life. I mean, just like for 10 years, I lived in Long Island in Queens.
Oh, okay.
So, and I went to a school in Boston. So I went to school with a lot of New Yorkers.
Yeah, I'm sure you did. Yeah. Oh, very cool. You know, I only when I was an adult did I ever get to New York City, because I was growing up in upstate. And it's called the Southern Tier. So it's the New York, Pennsylvania border.
Yeah.
But it was still far enough away from New York City. And, you know, we could go into town to get hayseed and rakes and anything we needed. So we didn't go to New York City.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was only about 6 years ago that I ever get to go to New York City for the first time.
It's funny because like upstate basically refers to like a ginormous part of the state, you know, like 30 Long Islands can fit, if not more, in all of upstate. Man.
Yeah, it's huge. And yeah. I have to explain, because we were talking before, you know, I live here in Brazil, and I always have to say, you know, eu morava in Nova York, mas não é cidade, estado. I lived in New York State, and it takes a while for it to compute. And I'm like, there's farms. It's all farms.
Yeah.
There's cities, but it's farm country.
Yeah, it's so how much of, I mean, this is probably a question that is not at all related to this interview, but I'm curious personally, how much of Brazil is like urban sprawl versus like uninhabited kind of nature?
I'll tell you, now I have not experienced all of Brazil, you know, it's ginormous, right? So I live in the capital of Santa Catarina. And so that's a real city, you know, and it's a big city and it's on an island predominantly. So there's only so much sprawl you can do before you have to build more land, which they've done before. However, going into the inland, into the continental side, the towns are, they're towns, you know, it's not cities. These towns that I visited in Santa Catarina, and they are very rural many times. The houses are very simple and basic. Even the Airbnbs many times reflect that. But they're cute and they have their own character. And many of the towns are becoming, I don't want to say tourist destinations, but they are, you know, growing up a population of people that are creating Airbnbs to go and visit. It ends up growing a set of businesses like restaurants and other attractions that are fun to experience. So I haven't been to many of the larger cities except for São Paulo, which is just, that's the largest city in the Americas. So that one, of course, is a, you know, it has a sprawl just by definition. But I don't know that I have enough experience to say for all the cities, but I can tell you that the state that I live in Santa Catarina is very, very rural and beautiful. These mountains and hills and canyons are just gorgeous, and they're all within driving time, a few hours drive.
What's like the business case or like the trade-offs that you experience, if there are any, in building like your company and living in Brazil? Like, because I guess maybe the question behind the question is like, I often wonder, like, what is the trade-off of not living in like a tech city, you know, because Nashville is not really one yet.
Yeah,
I experienced some degree of line loss. We're probably behind the power curve a little bit in terms of innovation. The talent, you know, may not be coming from the tier one companies. Right. And so I wonder if you think through that at all.
I'll tell you this, Florianopolis, where I live, reminds me often of a smaller Austin, which is where I used to live in Austin, Texas. So there is a large tech population here. There are incubators, co-working spaces. There's either a city or a state co-funded incubator just up the road from me, about 5 minutes, and they house a lot of startups and provide assistance to them. So this has been a good place to put some roots, just in respect to what you said, right? In fact, it's probably a good thing it's not Austin, because Austin is dealing with the challenges of being Austin. And all the people that have moved there for that reason. So when I started Planorama, it was a number of years ago. I started it while I was in Austin, but it was always remote. Most of the people that I work with, we all work remotely. In fact, some of them I've never met in person.
Yeah.
And yet we work together day to day.
Yeah.
And that was before the pandemic, right? So when the pandemic happened, it didn't affect us at all. We were already in our stride. In fact, most of the U.S. was catching up to that regard, saying, well, how's remote going to work? And we said, well, we'll be happy to show you. It works really quite well. but we've always had good experience. And in Brazil, there's, I think what I wouldn't normally say, well, no, I can say it, but we're in between time zones. We're GMT minus three.
Right.
So we have some clients that we work with that are in the UK and in Europe, right? And we're close enough where it's not too bad. And then, of course, the US time zones are not that far away.
Yeah.
So it puts us in a good location in order to be able to talk with anybody and sometimes bridge different teams that normally have a harder time because of their skew relative to each other in time zones. But a lot of the folks here speak English, and all of our team does as well. So, you know, we don't really have too many challenges. The challenge I have is finding designers who are senior enough that we can train. And when we bring them in, we train them how to do things our way, because we have a very heavy focus on organization and documentation and having a certain standard by which that we deliver requirements to the development teams for the clients that we work with. So we usually bring people in who are senior designers, and then we work with them to I'll say level up in some of these other areas, because that's what our clients pay for. They pay for that level of acumen, and we train our folks how to do that. But the nice thing is we're not location based, so we can get folks from anywhere.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, GMT minus three is nice. I mean, a couple hours away from the UK, and then I mean, you have to stay up late, I guess, if it's like a West Coast company. But you know,
we find times. There's enough crossover.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And that's what's nice about hiring in the Americas, because it's like there's not a broad range. How about for you? Do you feel like you're like, in terms of like your peers, other business owners, people working on solving problems, like at the business level, like you're able to establish like a network of people like doing very interesting things? Has that been relatively easy to do?
I'm a member of some online communities. There's some good ones. We have our own called AI Product Hive. And if you were to Google AI Product Hive, it'll take you there. And that's one of our online communities focused on AI for product teams.
Cool.
But I'm also a member of, and I'll just pump them, AI Explained, which has a great set of videos on YouTube. And I'm one of the Patreon sponsors there. And so I get involved in that community as well. And there's always opportunity to meet people online in those areas. And also you just have to reach out. You know, I do spend time on LinkedIn looking for people, not to sell to, but just to connect with and to speak with, share what we know, share what we've learned, because we're learning a lot in this day and age right now about how to design, how to manage requirements for projects that involve AI. And we've learned a thing or two by building our own software to help us with that. And we try to share that. I don't think I have it all solved. I know that I can do better with, you know, probably posting more videos or doing something on one of the many channels.
I'm so bad at that. My team gets on me about being more open. I'm like, how many freaking business owners are there on the internet saying this and this about their thoughts?
Yeah. I'll tell you what I refuse to do, though, and maybe I'm just being a stickler, but I refuse to drive in the car and take a video of myself talking to a camera about the product requirements, as if, you know, you just happened to get into my car on an Uber, you know, or refuse to walk down the sidewalk and do this. I am not there yet. And I don't know that I will be.
Well, you know, part of that, I think, is actually the lighting. Like the lighting, it like in an afternoon.
Oh, yeah.
With the phone there, like on the windshield, is like actually quite nice. And I think that's why people do it, you know, but
yeah, maybe
it's pretty weird. You know, I don't know. My extemporaneous thoughts are not that valuable. Like I have to think about what I need to say.
So I know what you mean. I have to do it too. I have to make notes and think. Otherwise I'm just rattling off and I get done with it. I'm like, I can't post that. That's terrible.
Yeah, totally. This actually hurts the credibility of the company.
Yeah, exactly. It's a net negative.
You know what's interesting is like we started doing like a motion to be a part of more conferences and just go out. I mean, it obviously helps the business, but also just more selfishly, it's engaging for me to meet other people working on interesting things.
Oh, yeah.
The genesis for the podcast, even.
Yeah, of course. You know, I started a tech community in Austin years ago. And part of the reason was to help engineers and tech folks get out from behind their computers and go meet each other, because I found that good things happened. And I used to say that networking was predictably unpredictable, right? Like, I can't tell you what's going to happen, right? That's the nature of it. But usually good stuff does.
No, that's so true. You know, so we were just in Austin for South by Southwest.
Oh, yeah.
That was the second time that I was in Austin, the first time for like work, not just like for fun and visiting the city.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell how much of that was due to the conference versus like just the underlying characteristics of the city itself. But I have to say, I mean, like people are doing interesting things there. And it felt like San Francisco in many ways. And you know, not as unsettling maybe as San Francisco. Because sometimes that's not a political claim. Yeah. Like sometimes the city itself and like how out there people are, like money is dead, you know, claims like that. That's just like fundamentally unsettling to me to hear. Yeah. I'm focused on like this specific HR issue in this company. I don't need to be thinking about like the Fed printing away our money.
Yeah. Well, Austin has naturally a pretty good culture that is established. And I think people get impressed with, I don't mean impressed upon them, but I mean that when they arrive, you start to notice that people are fairly forthcoming and trying to help each other out genuinely.
Wow.
And I'll tell you that when I started that community, it was called Door 64, by the way, D-O-O-R 64, named after my Commodore 64, which was the computer I really grew up with after the VIC-20. Because I was trying to serve many of those people that I, you know, were kind of like me, starting out in the 80s, you know, learning on these 8-bit computers and then moving ahead. But I found that people are very willing to talk about what they're working on. You just had to provide a catalyst, an opportunity for them to do that. And there's always this notion that engineers are introverted and will look at their shoes and, not engage. But that was not the case at all. Now, granted, there were some people that came into my events. I held in-person events. And they would kind of, walk in and they'd see 300-400 people and their eyes would kind of glaze over and they had that Bambi look. And I said, this is your first time here, right? And I explained to them how to network, how to meet other people. And I'll tell you, most of the time they came back to me at the end of the night, they were the last ones there. And they said, this was so much fun. I had such a good time. I met so many good people. And it was just having a bit of a recipe for putting this event together that allowed them to realize, hey, this is really good for me. And meeting other people is a great way for me to not only, spawn new ideas, but also perhaps find avenues for projects to work on. Because most usually engineers want to work on things of their own. And it certainly catalyzed building to find each other, right? And turn things into reality.
That's cool. So you're a connector. Have you done a lot of that in Brazil, like set up events and things like that?
You know, I'm thinking about it. It's funny you mentioned that. My challenge is that I don't speak the language. I don't speak Portuguese very well. As somebody said one time when I was in upstate New York, and they said, "Oh, you live in Brazil. Do you speak Brazilian?" Not at all. I'm just trying to get Portuguese. So,
yeah, you know, so I trained Brazilian jiu-jitsu. So there are a bunch of people, which is like a martial art. And
oh, yeah.
There are a bunch of people that like get so into like BJJ that they end up like, yeah. You know, their Portuguese is not great, but they end up adopting the Brazilian intonations, like the Portuguese intonations and like almost like cadence.
Yeah.
Other sentences, right? Which is something like it's like a downward inflection at the end of a clause versus
interesting
sentence. You know, huh. Like, grab the arm and then post, right? And that's my really horrible impression of like a native Brazilian moving to the US and like being a 5-time world champion black belt teaching basically kids.
Wow. Okay.
Wrestle. But yeah.
I've not gravitated to that yet. I just try to get the words out. I live on an island and they have a term for the folks. Like people from Rio are called cariocas. Wow. People from the island in this area called manazinhos. And they're all, you know, they kind of go back to the fisherman way of life. But they talk so damn fast. that I can't keep up, and they have all kinds of funny ways of saying certain types of concepts, and I just try to pick up on it. And I'll tell you, when my wife and her mom were talking, sometimes I couldn't understand them. You know, like I would sit back and laugh, and like I got nothing.
Were they speaking in Portuguese?
It's Portuguese, but it's a dialect. It's a there's accents. There's certain words, and it's just very fast. I'm originally from the Philadelphia area, and folks from Philly are known as fast talkers too. And so I don't know who would win in this bar fight. who's gonna get the award?
So a long time ago, maybe at this point 12 or 13 years ago, I used to live in China, like right out of school, and it was sort of like, you know, trial by fire. You just very little Chinese knowledge, like moving there. But if you go out and you drink and you party and you get to know people, then I feel like that actually it helps uncork like your own insecurities associated with speaking the language,
mm-hmm. and
comfortable saying things in a grammatically incorrect way. And so I found like my language skills like accelerated. Yeah.
People tend to be, and Brazil is fairly laid back.
Yeah.
And in fact, I find it from the other angle. I'm the one that is effectively the visitor, the non-native.
Yeah.
Right. And folks here, when I just start trying to speak Portuguese or I can get by, they always give me compliments and they encourage me, you know, if they're doing it. And I've never felt like an outcast or anything like that. And likewise, when I've spoken English, or they just look at me and they know I'm not from here. I don't know why, because there's so many Germans and Italians and Austrians and Ukrainians that live there, you know, from those places that moved here long ago. Somehow I still stick out. I'm the gringo. But even when they see that, they start trying English or they get concerned about their own ability. But if I can coax them out of it, their English is great. And I tell them that, and they had no idea. Right. But they just needed to hear it from somebody and be encouraged. And when I was, I visited China before. I didn't live there. I visited India and China and Malaysia and other places. Okay. And they would try to use their English. And sometimes it was for the express reason to test it out with a real American. And when I told them like, yeah, you sounded great. They would get so excited and happy. And I realized I made somebody's day, you know, just by validating that their English was good, understandable.
That's 100% true. Like you get into a cab. This was the case, I don't know, like 10 years ago, but like you would get into a cab and you'd have like a cab driver in China try to speak to you in English and try to work on their English. And
I would
work on my Chinese. So you have two people basically trying to communicate in the other language to try to practice.
That's right.
you know?
It's a good thing.
Totally.
I had a cab driver in China, by the way, call me beautiful, and I just took that for what it was worth. I think he was trying to pay a compliment, but I was like, wow, that was really nice. Thank you.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you would say Shuai as, I guess, yeah, that's funny. He's probably, like, I've heard somebody say that in a movie or something like that. Yeah.
He was smiling in the rearview mirror, and I just, you know.
I mean, my girlfriend does not allow me to smoke cigarettes now, but, like, this was a thing that you used to have to do in China to be polite.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, if somebody offers you a cigarette, even, like, a cab driver offers you a cigarette, like, you have to accept, otherwise.
You take it, yeah.
Yeah. High rudeness, you know, what, maybe we'll have to inhale, but like, you
have to do it. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. It's a travel like that does open the eyes, right? Does cause you to think about what, you know, how you are and how you live and what is polite and being and kindness and things like that. It's a good experience.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, like, if you're an entrepreneur, you likely have like a high degree of openness, you know? And so that probabilistically it makes you more right to be an expat and to travel and to enjoy that stuff. So is this your first, like, I mean, I guess you've been in Brazil for like basically half a decade. Is this the first time you've lived abroad?
It is.
Okay. Nice.
It is. Although you could say moving from upstate New York to Texas was like living abroad too. Let me tell you this, Deja. I had lived there and I had been there a couple of weeks and I was working at Motorola. Right. Started at Motorola as an engineer working in design. And we were sitting, this was back in, let's see, I moved there in 97. So it was like 97, 98. And I remember us all going out to lunch. And we were sitting at the Salt Lick out in Driftwood, Texas, sitting at a picnic table, all ordering barbecue. And we're talking about wafer fabrication yields on different lots coming out of the fab. And I remember just sitting there thinking, where am I? It was one of those zoom out moments where you think like, I'm in eating barbecue at a picnic table and we're talking about fab yield.
Yeah.
You know,
so how did you get from semiconductors to design?
It's funny, the folks, previous generations many times tried to work at the same company or they ended up working for the same company forever. And of course we know in Gen X and future that just doesn't happen normally. So I kind of bobbed and weaved in my career, trying to figure out what I like to do, what I was really good at. And so, yeah, I spent a little less than half my career in semiconductors, you know, working at Motorola. I worked in the back end. I have to remember this. The back end was everything after, from fabrication afterwards, basically after the design taped out. And I worked in that. It was called product engineering, product and test engineering. And you're responsible for the chip, for the quality of it, for testing, for production, like the ability to productize it, right? Ensure that it goes all the way to production and it can have sustainable yields. And you try to find ways to even, you know, make it more robust. And then I worked the other portion of my time in design, which was the I guess the front end, where everything it's before. So I was doing design and verification on PowerPC, but there was always that idea of test, both in the, when I was in the fab and doing work in with the chips, and then on the other side doing verification, you're testing a lot. And there's this mantra that, like, hey, if you don't test it, it doesn't work. you gotta test everything. But I ended up, through bobbing and weaving a bit in my career, I ended up getting out of semiconductors. I kind of saw the writing on the wall in terms of where that was going. And semiconductors can be very cyclical. And so I was part of one of the big layoffs they had in 2008, something like that. I forget. There was a downturn, right?
Yeah.
And, but I went in, and so that's where I was running the tech community. I'd already started in Austin and I was running that for quite some time. And I just kind of continued on that front. But then I moved into, product management. And what I found was that product management for software was certainly different than product management for hardware, but it certainly, leveraged some of my background because I, as an engineer, always appreciated understanding how things worked beneath the hood.
Yeah.
Right. I had a good understanding, not only from the chip side and the hardware side, but also from the software side. Like, hey, if the client says they want to do X, Y, and Z, I can tell you that X and Y are going to be pretty simple, but Z is going to be a real challenge, and here's why.
Right.
And that really helped in product. And in fact, I found that I was doing product management consulting without even knowing it when people wanted to go to lunch and talk about their ideas. And I was already helping them through that process without even realizing that was product management as a role. But I found that was a good fit for me. And then years later, I kept working in product. And then I ended up starting Planorama because honestly, I saw a gap. There was an area where design as a discipline was not being followed. And I don't mean UX design. I mean design just as a concept.
Right.
The planning that goes into the work that you're going to do does not happen many times in software like it does in hardware or almost every other engineering discipline.
Right.
Right. You can't have nobody would ever think, like, you don't get to tape out a chip without design. Design is creation of the chip. You don't go into designing you don't create a bridge without designing it. Right. Now, granted, they're all waterfall projects. Right. But there are some key reasons why you should have design as an integral step, and software tended to miss that. And then folks would wonder, why does the project go sideways? You know, why are there, you know, it seems like sometimes there's solutions and searches of problems because it wasn't thought through, or the software could be structurally built well, but nobody wants to use it, or it's a pain to use, right? Or nobody wants to buy it, or development costs or timelines are just being blown, right? And when you get down to it, there's a lack of design work, you know, involved, requirements.
How do you reconcile? So, like, I 100% agree. From my standpoint, it feels like in some ways the agile mindset seems to be, like, I don't want to say antithetical, but it seems in some ways the priors that, like, end up with agile as a mode of operation seem antithetical to, like, the principles of, let's say, project design and defining how this looks, feels, you know, not just like business value. Because I think, to your point, like, the agile process is like, what's the business value? Okay, we're going to break that out in like 2-week sprints, blah, blah, blah. And, like, you know, as long as we're hitting the metrics, like, we're fine. So there's no subjective assessment of, like, what is this going to be? Right. And in fact, in my experience, many engineers chafe at that, at that type of direction. So how do you hold these things in your head, and where does this play a role?
I think the problem, first of all, I think the problem that has been that, you know, software engineering cuts out design because they believe that somehow you're going to save money by doing that. You're going to save time and money in the process. Like, our engineers are smart. They know how to build it.
Yeah.
Right? And it's like saying our team of engineers can go build the bridge. We can just go build it, right? I'm like, well, yeah, I'm sure they can, right?
Yeah.
What happened with Agile is we threw the baby out with the bathwater, I think. I think we adopted, and rightly so, I think they were trying to pull the pendulum back and saying, you know what? We have some distinct advantages in software that allow us to do things that are different than how every other engineering project can be done. But it doesn't mean, like, for example, you know, working software over comprehensive documentation is one of the tenets, right? But it doesn't mean no documentation or that there's no intrinsic value to it.
Yeah.
Not quite the opposite. You're writing user stories, right? And many times what's happened, I've seen, is that those user stories become bullet points in the Jira ticket.
Right.
And they're like, developers, go. Like, well, what? Right. And then they spend the sprint just trying to figure out the requirements. You know, responding to change over following a plan is the other tenet, right? Doesn't mean that planning doesn't have any value. In fact, planning has a lot of value, especially in design, where you're trying to think through, hey, if we know that certain features are coming up, but or we anticipate that would be the case, a bit of thinking now can allow you to prevent a redesign later on. You're leaving the space open for those features to come into being, even though right now you're not going to build them. So what we do at Planorama is we certainly are inserting ourselves into that process to ensure that everybody's receiving what they need to execute on efficiently, right? They get it. The developers are getting the user stories. The test engineers are getting the QA documentation, the test documentation per user story. We write all of that, along with creating the designs for the front end team. And so everybody gets what they need, and you can iterate, right? And you can iterate and change direction, bob and weave. But this idea that agile, this extreme agile, where it's like, we don't need any of this stuff. We just got to communicate. It's like it, and then the project goes sideways. And then you end up blowing the budget. And you don't have any internal product documentation to go back up to. And so if you bring on a new development team or a new development team member or any product team member, they're like, well, how does it work? Well, you just got to go use it. Or we have some Jira tickets. They're like, ah, you know, like you lose all the value because you threw the baby out.
Yeah. What's the difference to you between, let's say, planning and design?
I see them as one and the same thing. Now, design, that term has largely been in software co-opted by UX, UI design. Yeah. Right. So
yes. Right? Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's hard to say. And what I say for Planorama is that we are software requirements and UX design. Right. That's almost like saying we're a car driver and we drive the car. But I have to say it that way because people think of design in a very narrow perspective. For me, in my head, it's all design.
Yeah.
It's all thinking through what are you going to build? What is the solution you need to build? How are you going to phase that out? What are you going to start on first? That planning, which is why it's called Planorama, right? To get the whole landscape, but there's that concept of you need to plan a bit. That ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. That planning up front and that work that you do to think about workflows and who's going to do what and what kind of users are involved, that is de-risking all the other work coming up, and de-risking reduces timelines and it prevents you from building something nobody wants. And it reduces cost because now developers have what they need to execute. They have the user stories well-written, flushed out. They're involved in the meetings that are reviewing. They're getting it ahead of time to give feedback. It's bringing structure to that process that I'll tell you, every time we do this, teams just execute super efficient downstream because they have what they need. So design, I think of design in a holistic view like we do in every other engineering discipline.
Do you consider product management within the scope of design?
Yes. They, product managers, that's a lonely job. I've said before, that's a tough one. It seems like a lot of things get put into that area. Yeah. And I think most product managers are hired and probably sold on the job of figuring out what do we need to build and going out and talking to customers, doing the research. And I think to a large degree, UX research and product managers, that area has been a bit muddled.
Yeah.
Right. Who's responsible for what? I think companies kind of come up with their own definitions of where the line is, or they work together, which I think it's a good idea for them to work together because they're all trying to solve the same problem. But yeah, I would say that product managers, are hired to be that outward facing person. And yet they're usually tasked with the product owner, get the development team going, get them executing, write the documentation. They're probably the ones who are tasked with writing the user stories.
Right.
So what we do at Planorama is we offload that from the product manager. We take direction from them and they can be the expert in their vertical, in their space. And it should be that way. But we're not going to know everything about their space, unless we happen to be working in semiconductors or EDA or places that we happen to know about. But we consult them, and then they are our primary contact to write the documentation, to design the features, to scope out what we're going to do. And then we execute. So we offload those extra duties that are, you know, it's a big switch for them to go and have to manage that. And most teams aren't set up for that kind of success. I'll go back to your original question. Yeah, the product manager is vital, but they're not always set up for success either.
Yeah. In your view, the ideal SDLC is something like product managers discover the problems or uncover them, define them explicitly, establish some metrics or some set of requirements that map to the problem being solved. The shape, like the contours of that solution, are then handed to, you know, your org or the design suite. That solution now has contours, roughly speaking, as well as an execution plan. Then that is given to engineers, or am I missing something?
No, it is that way, but I wouldn't say it is that strict handoff. You know, many times we're working with the product manager. They're talking about what they're seeing, what they're thinking about, what they've discovered. We're counseling them with what we've seen. You know, certainly we haven't seen everything. They haven't seen everything. So why don't we come together and talk it through? Sometimes during that process, we, as the UX design arm, will suggest tools we have in our tool belt to help, right? So great, you're hearing customers talk about this kind of feature. Why don't we prototype that?
Right.
And by the way, design naturally tends to, because design is focused on a solution to a problem, that naturally tends to break down silos. So we'll oftentimes start having conversations that say, hey, I think we need to bring in other people into this conversation, somebody from DevOps, somebody from development, somebody, one of the other stakeholders, right? And it naturally branches out these little dendrites to bring in the right people to talk about, well, do we need a prototype? Do we need a POC? Does development need to go and evaluate whether that API can handle the performance that we need in order to accomplish that? Right. So you're trying to get some of these activities started a bit early to, I'll use that word, de-risk. Right. Mm-hmm. So if we're going to go build it, let's do some steps in the beginning to evaluate whether that is the right thing, whether we should be spending money on it. Mm-hmm. Is it viable? The work we do with AI, especially, is that in that case, we work with companies on building, you know, generative AI into their solutions. Right. And some of the first things we're doing is not only thinking about, you know, how to design it in the UI, but even beforehand, like, can the Gen AI do it?
Right.
Right. People are throwing everything at it thinking like, oh, it'll solve all my problems. Like, let's do some POCs. And we know our way around the barn enough to be able to try it out ourselves or to tell their own internal team, like, hey, we need to test that this will work using unstructured data, and will it be able to extract the information you think it will be able to?
What's your view on risks associated with using LLMs, all the way from copyright to them training their models on other people's data? Yeah.
Well, that's a broad topic.
Yeah. And
I don't know that I'm qualified to speak about all of it. I certainly have ideas, right? But these AI, generative AI companies, let's just talk about OpenAI, but you could insert any of them here, right? OpenAI certainly has the most usage as of today.
Yeah.
The problem I think that people are overlooking is that the more that you get connected and using OpenAI or any of these services, the more you're getting married to them.
Yeah.
And they think of it as magic versus any other technology, IP, or service that you would integrate with. Wow. Where you have to ask some questions about, hey, am I getting married to this technology? Am I getting married to this particular service? How much of this is really providing value to my customers? And certainly from a design standpoint, we are interested in not just throwing AI in, as somebody, a friend of mine said, sprinkling it in because they had to, because the stock price would go down if they didn't. But actually putting it in real ways that make sense for people. AI has the potential to overload people, right? It can write a whole paper for you. Yeah. Great. I wouldn't go hand that in off the bat. You got to go back and edit it. Sometimes that whole editing process may take as long as just writing it from scratch, right?
Yeah.
It's an example.
Yeah.
But there are downsides from a UX standpoint that you need to consider. And of course, the other challenge I would say with language models, unlike code, is that you don't have any control over the output. It is not a not a repeatable process. You can put in a prompt the same way every time and get different types of data coming out of it. And over time, you have no control. There's no versioning on their end, right? There's no way to say, hey, I want to lock down this language model so that at least I can get some consistency. Many people have complained that GPT-4 has been degrading over time as they've been implementing structures to prevent bias, to prevent foul language or whatever it is, right? The more that you implement that, it's not a it's broad swaths that can perhaps remove or I should say degrade functionality in other areas, because it's a giant neural network. You can't go and say there's a bug there and fix it, right? So it's a big brush they're painting with, and it changes the model. So if you're building according to that model and what it provided you 3 months ago, you've got to keep looking at it to make sure it does provide what you think it is going to. And if you're tying a lot of your value in your product to the output of that language model, which many products, of course, have just come up as prompt front ends, you're really hoping you're hoping for that model to behave the same. So there's a lot of value in considering, if you're an enterprise, not just the idea that, hey, I don't want my data to leave my perimeter, right? I want to control that, but also the value in the model itself just not changing. So you may consider having, open source foundational language models that you build or manage there.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of them out in the Hugging Face community. There's a lot of really good models out there that you can run on your own hardware that cost very little. And by the way, of course, you're going to possibly spend less depending on the amount of tokens that you're throwing at it, right? Yep. It's an infrastructure cost. It's a fixed cost versus the variable cost of per token.
Yeah, totally. So, and the sort of downstream risk of the model changing and your prices.
Well, we did at Planorama, by the way, we've built our own solution to assist with product requirements. It's called Sinfonia. And we use OpenAI as part of that, but we also have the ability to use open source language models, and we've tested on that before. And so as part of that, we ended up building this reusable IP that is effectively a middleware that allows you to do RAG, to use real information from real-time locations that what the model wasn't trained on.
Right.
But it supports other things like semantic routing and caching and things like that. And this IP that we created, and we're licensing it out to other companies, but the whole idea is you need to know how to build that. And many of these companies who are just connecting to OpenAI, they don't know enough yet to realize that you have to abstract. You should think of this like anything else and abstract away some of these capabilities. And I get concerned that they're going to, again, get married to these providers, these language providers, and then have to back out later on or deal with ramifications because they're not thinking about it.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, it's a set of risks that I don't think the overall, tech community has been apprised of to the extent that it should. And unfortunately, the most, vocal proponents are talking their own book, so to speak.
this subject. That's right. There's a lot. It's nascent. There's so much that people are trying to figure out, and it seems like magic. Yeah. So in some ways, it does remind me of the Bitcoin bubble from a few years ago, but not because the technology is bad or not. I mean, look, I actually think that blockchains are going to play a role with AI in the future, but there was a lot of hype over it because the money seemed like it was just free money. Here, I think people are thinking, oh, it's free magic, and it's not. It is magic. It's really, it hit the market kind of out of left field, right? And people thought, this is amazing. Look at all the things we can do with this. We just never had this before. We thought, as kids, that we didn't think we would have watches you could talk to and see people on. And now we have video calls like this from across the world. We didn't think that was the case. And so now we're seeing something brand new that we out of left field that we never thought was possible with Transformers. And people go a little crazy. But we've got to remember to kind of pull ourselves back down to earth and realize that there's, you know, let's do it in the right way. And enterprises, I think, are probably the most apt to benefit, but also they have to be careful because they have big customers and they need to be careful with the data going out. And that's why when we consult companies on design, we're thinking along those lines too, you know, like, hey, let's reel it back in a bit and make sure that we're doing this in a smart way.
Yeah. How do you separate your concerns, like practically from a day-to-day standpoint, between like your professional services business and the R&D initiatives that you're involved in, like Symphonia and so on?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. Our tagline for Planorama Design, which is the professional services, has been time to market accelerated by design. And the work that we've done in our R&D side has been focused on emerging technologies, areas that we have interest and that are certainly aligned to how we think about requirements. Symphonia being one of them as a tool for addressing that, both, by the way, in software and in hardware. We have both of those areas that we that Symphonia can tackle. What I would say is that we are using the knowledge and understanding and what we learn from Planorama Labs and emerging tech to inform us how to go back and do design better, how to manage requirements better, how to, you know, because we know generative AI so well, as well as anybody can in this nascent time, but we actually have experience designing it for it and knowing what happens underneath the hood. We're able to you know, make that much more progress and design capabilities and products and features that are certainly providing value and are buildable, right? Are manageable. So I think of it as even the IP that we've created, that middleware that I talked about that we're licensing out, it's an accelerant, right? You don't have to build it yourself. So it is driving time to market for these features, for products. We're doing it both as a professional service and we have IP that supports that same motivation, right? If we've already built it and if you want to license, if you want to build it yourself, you can too. We're not going to get in the way of that. But we certainly are trying to provide a set of services and tools that allow you to accelerate, you know, features and products to market. And I'll even say the right features and the right products to market that are the best positioned to be successful.
Do you ever think about going the venture-backed route, or are you happy running your org without somebody?
You say venture-backed in what way? Like taking Symphonia and doing something with it?
Yeah.
I wouldn't turn down the idea of it. I mean, look, here's the thing about agencies that I've found is that when they get to be a certain size, you lose some things. You lose some culture. And I'm not saying we're at that max size yet. I'm not anywhere near what I'd like to be for professional services. We're still bringing on more clients and still growing. But there's a point at which you lose some abilities. And for me, I'm involved in most every project that we're working on to some degree. It's kind of like Charles Ames, you know, from his design shop, right? He was involved in every project and he kind of had his name and stamp of approval on it. And I've kind of thought about that model and I like it. I like being involved because, you know, as I mentioned in the beginning, I kind of wanted to find what I like to do when I grow up. And I like to do this. I like to come in and solve problems, think holistically about what they're trying to accomplish, bring the team together. We all put our heads together and try to ensure that they're, you know, going down the right path. So, I wouldn't turn down having somebody want to you know, participate in working with us on Symphonia. I'm not allergic to money. I just put it out that way. But I like the professional services that we provide because I'm trying to really solve problems.
Yeah.
And if there is opportunity to grow our work on Symphony and accelerate that and get that in more people's hands to drive growth and to solve real problems, then I'm all for it. You know, and I'll take that on a case by case basis. You can put my number at the bottom of the screen, 1-800.
It's mostly developers, but I have heard feedback there that there are some other types of stakeholders who
do
this podcast. So
yeah, I'm not the best marketer, and you mentioned it before. Like I really am more of an engineer, and I get allergic to seeing people that hype projects that are not up to snuff, right? And I'm usually the opposite. I'm the kind of person who's like, well, it's good enough, you know, but it could be a whole lot better. And then people come back and say, no, it's really good.
That's my personality. Yeah, I don't know. In this world, it seems like there are rewards for being a vocal proponent of your, I don't know, of what you're working on, but it feels awkward. You know, it's like the digital equivalent of like walking into a room being like, I'm very smart. Please look at what I'm doing.
That's right.
Which is like really awkward to do. If you're like at a bar and that's how you initiate a conversation, people are like, who is this person?
Yeah, that's right.
Like, what is happening?
That's right. And I get it. I've never been really good at that self-promotion because I like to say that our work speaks for itself.
No doubt.
The problem I have with our professional services is that we're under NDA for most of this stuff, so we can't show. So like, it's behind the curtain, but believe me, it looks really good. And we did a great job. I just can't prove it. But but we do have enough projects that we can show that we do have that, you know, demonstrate our work. But look, at the end of the day, design is solving problems. And we look at it, we're solving a problem for product teams who just need to be able to execute, get products out the door, get up the right product out the door, and have good internal documentation, solve a lot of those problems that have been thrown out with the bathwater. the benefits of good documentation and the benefits of the kind of work that we do are intrinsic to the team now, and we execute, have good process. We bring a lot of there's a guy I know who has a podcast called Chaos to Clarity, and I was like, the best way to say it is, yeah, we bring clarity to otherwise process chaos, right? Chaos in terms of budget, timelines, whatever it is. And I'm not going to take his term, but I'm going to use it. because it's a good one, and it's probably the best way to say what we do.
Yeah.
So
that's awesome. Where can people find you, Matt?
If you go to planorama.design, so it's PL, right? planorama.design/Matt. They'll find me there. It kind of has a bit about me, but if you just go to Planorama Design, you'll see where we are. And I have on that /Matt link, I have a area to set up a time to talk or way to reach me on LinkedIn. So if folks want to continue the conversation or chat about anything we've spoken about, happy to network, happy to get on a call.
Cool. Please reach out to Matt. He would love to hear from you. We have a ton of developers who listen to this, so I think they would want to talk shop. And I wish you had more of an opportunity to dig into your background, because you have a CS background and an electrical engineering background, if I'm not mistaken.
It's computer engineering and electrical masters. Computer engineering is half software anyway. So
yeah,
it's all good. So
please reach out to him, guys. Show us the love. Thanks, Matt. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Tejan.
You're listening to the Founder to Founder podcast, powered by Gun.io's Frontier Network. We release a new episode every Thursday morning, so be sure to subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you stream your music. Please leave us a review and share with your friends. You can follow us online at The Frontier Pod, or drop us a line at team@gun.io to get in touch about hiring world-class tech talent. Thanks for listening to the Frontier podcast produced by Gun.io. We're the only freelancing platform where engineers actually go to hire other engineers. If you want to learn more about how to hire or freelance with us, head over to Gun.io and get in touch. Let us know you heard the podcast, and we'll pay for your first 10 hours with a kick-ass engineer.